ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
We think that social housing ought to be good enough, and it's a horrible phrase.
I'd call it the naturehood, the neighbourhood of nature.
Big questions, real solutions. Life Matters with me, Tegan Taylor, is where your stories shape the national conversation.
I'm nobody's darling, believe you me.
It would have been true love from the beginning.
We unpick big stories that matter to you. Find it on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, Donald Trump may have backed down over Greenland for now, but he's not alone in his Arctic ambitions. Why is a stake in the polar region now so desirable for so many?
Well, it's not just the Huskies, Geraldine. The permafrost is melting and suddenly so much is up for grabs, from resources to sea access.
To a strategic foothold at the top of the world between Russia and the United States and Canada and others. Look, it's about power and authority.
And even China is talking about a polar Silk Road. I'm Latika Burke.
I'm Geraldine Doogue. Grab your snow boots. Today, global roaming sets course for the Arctic. Yes, Latika, it certainly is this area that I think most of us barely spell suddenly becomes the focus of so much attention. Maybe I should just do a tiny definition for people at the start. The eight Arctic states are the US, Canada, Denmark, Iceland, Norway, Sweden, Finland, and Russia. So I think that might just get people. 14 million square kilometres really sort of wrapped around the North Pole. Have you been anywhere near there? Latika?
Geraldine, I actually bought my only pair of snow boots to go to Iceland. I think this was about 5 or 6 years ago. I have to say Iceland is one of my top five countries. It is incredible.
Why? In brief?
Well, I mean, there is obviously, Geraldine, the extreme weather. We went there in winter and, I mean, it's literally dark nearly all day, which is an experience in itself. If you're really adventurous, you can dive and touch two continental shelves if you are really, really kind of up for it. I think that's on my bucket list for next time.
See, this is the thing. There's a lot of romance around this area, partly because, you know, we don't know it. But it is defrosting. So suddenly people are realising that it could become a power struggle between some of the most powerful parts of the world. And obviously Donald Trump's fascination just alerted people to this, but it's well and truly underway. Like Russia now has 40 military facilities along the Arctic coast. And the Canadians have set up an embassy, haven't they, in Greenland, and the French are going to follow suit.
Yes, there's no doubt about it that Donald Trump has turned the world's attention here. But, Geraldine, we don't want to put or give him all the credit, because if you think about what happened after the war in Ukraine, two countries joined NATO. Which were they? Sweden and Finland, two of the Arctic countries. They bring to NATO a lot of this Arctic expertise, actually, along with Norway as well. But it's interesting that when Ursula von der Leyen, for example, was at Davos trying to rebut Donald Trump's claim on Greenland, one of the examples she used was actually Finland is already there. Finland has the icebreakers. They have the best in the world. And by the way, United States, you don't have any icebreakers. They're trying to acquire them. So in terms of readiness, what Donald Trump often misses, as he is wont to do, is that capability for securing this region is there, even if his attention has only just turned to it, and perhaps a lot of us as well.
One of the reasons why maybe we didn't turn our attention to it was because it had been a real zone of peace. The USSR, which lasted until 1991, viewed the Arctic as a prime strategic arena against the United States. But when Mikhail Gorbachev, the last Soviet leader, came to power, he declared the Arctic a zone of peace, a sort of Arctic exceptionalism. Here he is in a speech for the United Nations General Assembly in 1988.
The use or threat of force can no longer and must no longer be an instrument of foreign policy. This applies above all to nuclear arms. But that is not the only thing that matters. All of us, and primarily the stronger of us, must exercise self-restraint and totally rule out any outward-oriented use of force.
I mean, this is an ancient way of thinking. Self-restraint? Who has this anymore, Geraldine?
I mean, he helped end the Cold War at the cost, you know, he plunged his own country into economic chaos and so on and so forth. And it's only really since, as you say, that invasion of Ukraine that this zone of peace has been fundamentally challenged, and now the US is beginning to feel the need to compete. Which was why, Latika, I was very happy to speak to Klaus Dodds. He's a professor of geopolitics at the University of London. And he's the co-author of Unfrozen, The Fight for the Future of the Arctic. And he is completely captivated, as you'll find out, by this remote part of the world. Here he is now. Klaus Dodds, welcome to Global Roaming.
Thank you. Really pleased to be with you.
Now, Klaus, I think most of us will never visit the Arctic, sadly, whereas you are bewitched by it. I think that's the proper verb. Help us understand, please, why you are.
Yes, I mean, I think for several reasons. I mean, first of all, because professionally speaking, the Arctic is really a gooder place as any to really make sense of what does it mean to see a part of the planet that is undergoing state change almost in real time. In other words, that compared to the vast history of the Earth itself, it is remarkable that you can speak to scientists, you can actually go and visit parts of the Arctic and see for yourself, sea ice is declining markedly, for example. Permafrost, which was once permanently frozen ground, is thawing. Glaciers are retreating. So there's something very embodied, I think, about being in the Arctic, where climate change really, really feels like it's got first order effects. I think a second issue for me, geopolitically, this has just been a place that just keeps on attracting in one form or another, great power aspirations. It's also got remarkable stories about indigenous autonomy, which, you know, may well interest Australian listeners, for example. But, and the other thing that there's no getting away from, it is truly stunning. It is spectacular. There is something magical being in Svalbard, racing along on a skidoo at 70 miles an hour, enjoying the view whiz past you.
Mm. And we're going to return to some of those features later as we talk. But the point that I got anyway from your writing and others is that until relatively recently, certainly since the end of the Cold War, it looked as though that place you described was going to be a real island or zone of peace, as the last Soviet president, Mikhail Gorbachev, described it, which seemed to work for years. But now you're very concerned that things have changed drastically. That's the sort of clarion call you're issuing, isn't it?
Yes, I think that's absolutely right, because I have literally just returned from the Arctic city of Tromsø in northern Norway. And this week, all the discussion is about the Arctic in the annual Arctic Frontiers Conference. And it's really interesting. I was saying to a colleague there that, you know, 20 or 30 years ago, we were preoccupied about creating this circumpolar region of peace and collaboration. The biggest concern we had with Russia was not whether it was going to invade another country or not, but how on earth were we going to deal with the toxic legacy of Cold War militarism. And this is where we had spent nuclear fuel rods, we had abandoned nuclear submarines. And the big concern that Norway had was, how can we decontaminate? And Russia was seen as a relatively benign partner in all of this. And you're quite right. Without Gorbachev's vision of a zone of peace, for example, the Arctic Council, the premier intergovernmental forum that helped to kind of create this culture of goodwill and respect, might never have come to fruition.
Just tell us about the detritus from the Cold War, because that occupies, again, you've got quite some examples in your work, and that the people there have learned to live with them, you know, learned to live with cast-off tables and sort of old material, defence material.
Yes, I mean, there's a really wonderful filmmaker called Ivalo Frank, And she's based in Berlin, and she made this great short film called Echoes. And one of the things that Ivalo does in her work, and certainly the book tries to speak to as well, is that whilst we were often lionizing this Cold War epoch of circumpolar goodwill and collaboration, there was this troubling legacy of militarism and national security planning that made itself felt very, very visibly in the Arctic, and not just in Arctic environments, like things being dumped in seas, for example.
You say the things that are taken there are very rarely taken out. That's the secret.
Yes, I'm afraid the Arctic was a dumping ground, but it was also an experimental ground as well. So those toxic legacies are not just toxic to, for example, the land, the sea, the ice, the air. They're also toxic to Arctic communities. So actually, human beings were experimented upon during the Cold War because there was this sort of weird fascination with how northern peoples make sense and cope with cold environments. So when I also talk about hope and resilience in Arctic communities, it's partly touching upon those toxic legacies. The Soviets just dumped everything and anything they didn't want in the Arctic. They just did not care about that part.
Yeah, and this is, as you say, this sort of combination of the geopolitical and ecological crises just sort of crossing over. NATO is now taking a great deal more interest, even before all the latest Greenland spat, which sort of alerted, I think, a lot of us, you know, actually started looking into that part of the atlas. Now, that NATO interest is going to delight Nordic countries who've been pushing for this for a while. What defence facilities and weaponry is there right now, Klaus?
So the Arctic, in essence, is split into two. And it's worth saying that 50% of the Arctic is in one form or another part of the Russian Federation. The other 50% is a combination of European states, some very small like Iceland, and of course the United States and Canada. So we often talk about three parts of the Arctic: European, North American, Russian. Now, in the Russian Arctic, over the last 20 years, we've seen the extraordinary remilitarization of the Arctic North. So lots of bases, runways, and facilities designed to protect the Russian North. The United States is very concerned about missiles and homeland security, and Russia does have an arsenal of missiles, both land-based and sea-based. In the European Arctic, that's arguably less militarized, just because those countries, as Donald Trump would say, haven't spent as much as they should on defense, including facilities. And then finally, in the North American Arctic, really what you're talking about is Alaska, which has those military facilities. The Canadian Arctic, vast, but as Trump would say, poorly defended. And noticeably, as probably a lot of people now appreciate, the United States has always had, since the early 1950s, a presence in Northwest Greenland. So it's a mixed affair, but the Russian Arctic is the most militarized.
Well, indeed, it's the home of the Russian Northern Fleet, isn't it, which houses six of Russia's 12 nuclear-powered subs. It's got by far the biggest footprint there, as you say. And this is a pillar of Russia's strategic deterrence, which Putin is obsessed with in the whole modernising. Is anything really threatening that, though? I mean, China's definitely trying to come in as a sort of a neo-Arctic state. But seriously, is anything threatening? Should Russia have any reason for concern?
Well, again, I think you have to put yourself in the Russian mindset or the Putin mindset. There's two things you need to understand about Putin's Russia. First of all, lying is a form of statecraft for the Russian Federation, and it's industrial and very, very well developed. So whatever Russia says, you need to have a healthy dosage of skepticism as you listen in to the commentary. The second thing is that from Russia's point of view, there's a story to be told. The story is that the European Union and NATO expanded eastwards and they imperiled Russia. And Russia doesn't think that Ukraine deserves to exist as an independent state. And that's part of the reason why we see what we see over the last 4 or 5 years, tragically. On the other hand, Russia has always been shaped by its geography. So it tells a story about itself that where can we secure access to beyond our land borders. So there's always this obsession with the Black Sea, the Baltic Sea, the Pacific, and the Arctic. And of course, what Russia thinks is, if the Arctic is melting, if the Arctic is becoming more accessible, then sea ice, which was the unpaid sentry of the past, is no longer as relevant. And then on top of that, thanks to sanctions, Russia pivoted to China, certainly after the illegal annexation of Crimea in 2014, and has become ever more dependent on that relationship with China. And China, of course, benefits with lots of discounted oil and gas, and has been a key player in extending the Ukrainian conflict, because it benefits China.
But they're not in the Arctic. Is China in the Arctic?
China is absolutely in the Arctic. China has had a presence on Svalbard for 20-odd years. That's the Norwegian archipelago, about 600 miles from the North Pole. China is a huge polar science player. And China, last year, conducted a number of submersible expeditions to the bottom of the central Arctic Ocean.
Yes, I should say one of the things you pointed out is that the mainland is not the goal. It's just too inhospitable. You know, you've got sort of 80% of it is just an ice sheet. But the threats come via air or underwater. So this is what it's all about, is it? And I mean, maybe you can actually tell us about, because you've been to some of these facilities, haven't you? You've been inside them. Not yes. The Russians or mainly the Western ones?
No, mainly the Westerns. I can absolutely assure you, I'm not on President Putin's Christmas card list. And I don't think I'm going to get any invitation to see some of those facilities for fairly obvious reasons, regardless whether I'm on a Christmas card list or not. But the point is this. Is you're absolutely right. The thing to think about the Arctic, and our maps do not help us. You have to think of the Arctic as a volume. So the Arctic has height, it has depth, it has width. And the key thing is, from our point of view, as Europeans in particular, we are very concerned about critical infrastructure on the seabed. The Norwegians are very concerned about fish stocks coming in and out of the Barents Sea, that's the waters directly north of Norway and Russia. And everybody is concerned about things that go through the Arctic, including missiles. And one of the reasons why Donald Trump is obsessed about Greenland is because it feeds into this idea of missile defense, homeland security, and of course, connections to outer space are crucial, because the one thing the Arctic lacks is really good, reliable satellite coverage. And everybody is obsessed with domain awareness, whether it's underwater, whether it's looking to the skies. It's almost like we're back to the Cold War again. Everybody is interested in terms of what's going on beneath the surface, as well as what's going on through the Arctic.
Why isn't there satellite coverage?
Well, it's to do with the remoteness of the places themselves. It is also due to the curvature of the Earth that interrupts and disrupts satellite signals and the ability of satellites to communicate with ground control stations. So where you do have sophisticated satellite coverage and connectivity, such as Norway has in Svalbard, that is considered to be a strategic asset. So it's a huge preoccupation of every country, and in particular, of course, military and commercial stakeholders.
Apparently, like some of these ballistic missiles that the Russians have up there, they could, in theory, reach US cities in 18 minutes. So you can, to be fair to Trump, you can understand that he might want something like the Israelis' Iron Dome up there, this Golden Dome I think they're talking about. Now, I mean, is that on the cards? Is anybody working on that?
Yeah, so Trump is very, very preoccupied with the Golden Dome. There is no question at all. What the United States is very concerned about is really strategic military parity with China. And so for many, many years, the United States was clearly the dominant military superpower, and special friends like Israel benefited from that access in terms of technology and military sophistication. But as the United States, I think quite reasonably, by the way, in terms of its national security strategy, has read that the world is becoming more complex, multipolar, fractured, and ruptured, in Mark Carney's terms, there is this growing preoccupation that hypersonic missiles that Russia has quite a few of, do pose a potential threat. So when Trump talks about Western hemispheric dominance, I'm afraid Greenland is kind of collateral damage, because actually what he's...
But he could do that now, couldn't he? He could do that. That's the theory. I mean, the Danes would agree, I think.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is you know, blunt force trauma geopolitics, as I've called it in the recent past. This is not subtle stuff. This is punishing smaller states, including Canada, for being delinquent, in Donald Trump's terms, in terms of their defense spending. So this is taking out your frustration and anger at Europeans. Never, of course, the United States doesn't care for the European Union either. So what you find is, and this is part of the story I was interested in thinking through as well, is how the Arctic becomes part of a wider, almost like a great game, where I'm afraid Europe is in the crush zone between a revanchist Russian, an ambitious China, and an angry and vengeful United States.
Yes, with the polar ice melting. And whether that changes things, like, you know, that amazing story that you've got in the book that in some cases anthrax spores that have been buried for centuries are released, causing outbreaks in parts of Siberia.
For me, the cruel irony of all of this is that whatever happens, the Arctic will continue to melt, thaw, and burn. And that's another thing to bear in mind, is that for all the big talk about Russia being this enormous great Arctic power, Russia's also got huge territories that are going to be ever more troublesome because of that burning, melting, and thawing. And at the same time, if that wasn't enough, they're depopulating as well. And that's a real challenge across the Arctic. And that's why indigenous northern communities have to be front and center, as we try to in the book as well, make the case, which is these are places that will continue to depopulate, and militarizing them makes them less attractive to live in as well.
Where should the efforts be made in the immediate future, do you now think, Klaus, to keep the place stable and peaceful and maybe a decent home for the indigenous peoples? Because, I mean, some of the countries involved appear to be playing very long games indeed, very much placing long-term bets. So, I mean, can it remain a zone of peace of some sort?
Yes, I mean, I think there are for me a number of things that we need to keep a little bit of optimism about. First of all, don't underestimate the resilience and the courage of Indigenous and Northern communities. I, for one, was very, very taken by the firm response by the government of Greenland and Denmark to the repeated threats to the territorial integrity of their country. I actually thought that was really, really impressive. That's not easy, standing up to a country that looks and feels like it's just bullying a smaller country. The second thing I would say is Europe and Canada and also like-minded allies will need to step up. And if nothing else, focus their energies on the European Arctic and try and keep that as safe and secure as possibly can. Do not be fooled for 1 minute that the relationship with Russia will change. It won't. That is a long-term condition now. Russia is a threat to Europe, and we need to wake up to that. Thirdly, despite what's happening in the United States, it remains a very complex country that can't just be reduced to President Trump and his administration. And I shouldn't rule out civil society, and you never know, Congress might discover or rediscover there is a separation of powers and there's supposed to be checks and balances. So don't write the United States off yet, but just bear in mind China, India, United Arab Emirates, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, they're all taking an interest in the Arctic, and they don't have to deal with the legacies of community maintenance, territorial defense. They can come in and come out, and there's plenty of money to throw at it. So there's no moments for complacency. And we've got to remember that whatever happens, as we try to say repeatedly in the book, the Arctic will continue to melt, burn, and thaw. And whatever we do, and however quickly we transition away from hydrocarbons, a lot of that warmth is now locked into the system.
Klaus Dodds, you're a great booster for the Arctic. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Geraldine, what a great interview. Thanks for taking that on, by the way.
Yeah, look, he was a delight to interview. I mean, people who can basically see the overview, you know, they can see the strategic implications, they can see the people, they can see the natural world in all its beauty and how it's challenged. I love those sort of people, and I thought he encapsulated it all. And he wasn't, I mean, he's wary, but he's not pessimistic fundamentally, is he? Or did you think he was?
No, actually what I took from that, which really resonates about why this whole Trump move on Greenland right now is so absurd in people's minds for so many reasons, is that we're not there yet. We're not at the critical threat stage yet. So we actually have some time to prepare for this, and I think that's more the question. I was very intrigued about him talking about how much of this sea traffic is probably more likely going to take place underwater than over water. And that gets me thinking, where will we be by the time these routes really open up? Will we be having unmanned systems? Maybe what we know about how to protect and secure this area is not even envisioned yet.
Meanwhile, I am actually pricing going there for a visit. It's made me completely fascinated by the whole thing, and
I give you a tip? Go to Iceland for New Year's Eve, because it's the one night of the year they allow everybody in Iceland to buy fireworks. And so you just see the sky go bananas, then they all go off and have pagan bonfires. I'm not even joking. It is the most fantastic New Year's I've ever had. And as someone who's had a Sydney Harbour Bridge New Year's Eve, that is a big call, I know, but I'm willing to make it.
I cannot beat that. Now, we've had some lovely feedback of late, and we're just going to do a couple at the end of each episode. This is from Andrew. Dear Global Roaming, I was lucky enough to visit Iran. This is following our Iran chat last week, Latika. During that brief interregnum following Obama's nuclear deal, I have never received such hospitality in all my travels. Just a few thoughts. I was walking through the main square in Isfahan, maybe 14 or 15, bailed me up for a talk. We chatted for about 10 minutes. While I was listening to your podcast, I realised that young girl would be in her mid-20s now, and I worry she would have been among the protesters. I really hope she is safe.
And Geraldine, that just brings home the importance of why we're talking about Iran and bringing to light these very human stories.
And look, we're hoping to speak to Vali Nasser on Friday's show. Now, Vali Nasser is one of the most respected commentators on Iran for many years, and he will undoubtedly be giving advice at the very highest levels. I have no doubt about it.
But look, we love that you're listening, and we love that you're writing to us. Keep it coming, good, bad, constructive, whatever. You can write to us at global.roaming@abc.net.au. And Kylie and I are back tomorrow, and I've got to say, it is so wonderful logging on from London and hearing your so familiar, comforting voice in my earphones. It's like
around
a warm
for years.
Blanket.
Oh, thank you, Latika.
I did not say that, Geraldine. No. I did not say that.
Well, look, it is a privilege to have been around watching the world unfold, you know. So, look, there's a lot to come, and we try to make it interesting and not overwhelming. So lovely to have your company all around. Speak next week, Latika.
See you next week, Geraldine.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.